Welcome, pudding people, to another episode of Everybody Loves Pudding, Ken's Movie Reviews. I am your host, not Ken, here to discuss one of the best films I've seen in quite some time, and that, of course, is the delicious Dune 2. Now, for most of you who are listening to this, you may or may not know that between Ken and myself, that the direction we like to go a lot of times in things in general, whether it's TV shows, movies, reading material, right? We have a lot of interest in fantasy and sci-fi. Star Trek fans, I'm probably a bigger Star Wars fan for sure than he is. We definitely like traditional sci-fi, non-traditional sci-fi. And what you get with the Dune series is a sci-fi picture show, of course, with some fantasy aspects of it also, but maybe leaning a little bit more towards sci-fi. Now, of course, there was the original film that was out quite some time ago, and I've got a review up for that one. That was up years ago when Dune Part 1 was released, because I felt like it was good to review the original film before the new generation of the film, or films plural, was released. So the Dune 1 review is available on our website as well. And I gave that film pretty high marks as well. If I'm not mistaken, that score was an 84. 4 out of 100 using our patented scoring model, which I'll go over in just a moment. But I want to say that if you are going to be watching this movie, I would hope that you would watch one, because it gives you so many updates, details, baseline story knowledge that you're going to need for part two. Now, if you were a fan of the original movie back in, you know, the 80s, that is its own thing. This is a new thing. I will preface any of this discussion points with one thing, though. I have never read any of the Herbert original material. I don't know the source material. I read a book once. The end. So when it comes to a lot of source material for things, I am not going to know what these things are truly based on, how accurate, inaccurate the source material is. But what I will say is that between the first iteration of this back in the 80s and these, there are definitely some similarities, of course, but there are a vast amount of differences. And I think the differences more play upon what the original material is based on. Now, that being said, if you've watched the first remake, Dune 1, Dune 2, it's a must watch. If you enjoyed the first one at all, you had to have some interest in what was going to happen. And the thing about it is, after watching part one, you knew that there wouldn't be a sequel. There would be multiple sequels. And after watching this one, there's definitely more story to tell, a lot more story to tell. And I will say that this one, I think the word I can say is engrossed. I was engrossed in watching this. When I was looking at the show times, and it's harder for me to go watch movies based on my days off, or based on trying to go later at night. Later at night would be great. But the movie theaters around us they don't provide good movie times, and I imagine most don't anymore. So I was able to watch this on a Friday afternoon at 1:30, and this is a 3-hour movie. So you know you're going to get 20 minutes worth of trailers, and then almost 3 hours worth of movie after that. So plan accordingly if you haven't watched this and are planning on watching this. But it's a must watch. It's a must watch in the theater. It's a great watch. I really don't know. I wish it was longer than 3 hours, if that sounds crazy. The movie was excellent. It was top notch. Anybody who is a sci-fi fan, you could actually go to, for a short period of time, you could go to Netflix and watch Dune Part 1. But Max is kind of that location for that source movie, if you're going to go watch 2. And you honestly, you might have seen a lot of positive reviews. You might have seen a lot of memes. You might have seen a lot of things going on revolving around Part 2. And if they're all giving you that good vibe, it's accurate. It's a great movie. It's for sure 100% worth watching. So we're going to get into the actual review. It's going to follow along the normal review path that we would do as a group when we are reviewing movies, right? So we give it a score based out of 100, 0 to 100, and then it kind of falls into a score, right? You know what? We're going to go by grades. If something gets a 70, that's a C. That's an average. That's not bad, right? So if you give it a B, an 80, that's a good score. We have multiple categories that we're going to kind of dive into, and each have their own collective set of points available to them. And most of the time we go down by cast, director, locations, props, cinematography, score, and then the overall plot has big chunks. Like there's some of these have big chunks and have total score possibilities in them. And then we break down the categories and we get a score with the potential for bonus points at the end for us to manipulate the score as we see fit. So I could start with any of the categories, but you know what? We're just going to go right down the list, and I'm going to do the cast first. Now, the thing about a big epic movie like this is if you're going to put it into multiple parts, you need to be consistent with the cast across multiple parts. Can you have the same people appear in 1 and 2 and 3? And if you're not going to film them all subsequently, like this isn't a Lord of the Rings thing. They did Part 1 and were hoping it was successful, and then years later brought back everybody to do 2. And lucky for us, it's the same peeps, right? Everybody's consistent in this. The thing about this Part 2 is that there are a bunch of new faces that showed up. And I'm telling you what, the cast in this is really, honestly, it's top notch. The main character that you're going to see throughout this, there's a handful of main characters, but the main one that you're going to be focusing on, playing the role of Paul Atreides, is Timothy Shamalama Ding Dong. I mean, Chalamet. And I feel like in certain respects, maybe not from the younger crowd, but from the older crowd, there's kind of a negative vibe around him. But I'm telling you what, man, he's great in this. He was great in the first one. He's great in the second one, too. The roles, the parts are believable. So I don't really know if he deserves any of the negativity, but I'd say he was great. Then you'll see a lot of Zendaya, and she's probably, there's a handful of characters that you're going to see a lot of FaceTime with, and of the characters, I'll get to one more appearance by another actor in here. I would say Zendaya is of the larger scale group of actresses. She's probably the weakest one in here, and she wasn't exactly great in the first film, but much better in this one. Really, truly much better in this one. Rebecca Ferguson is in a lot of things, right? And she's got to play a mother. She's got to play almost like an overlord of a certain sense in here. She's got to play a priestess. She's got to play a mother. I mean, a priestess mother. Like, she's got to play a really character that you have to appreciate but hate at the same time. It's interesting. And she's great. Javier Bardem is always good at anything he does. He's pretty good in this. Not great, but he's pretty good in this. Josh Brolin is excellent, overzealous. He's always got a presence about him. And I really kind of enjoy what we got to see from him in this. A little bit more action, right? You saw the action in the first one for sure. More stout, more resolute. But this one, he's been in a situation for a long time on this planet. And that kind of stout, resolute type has to fall off just because of the situation. So he does great. And those, of course, are some of the main bodies that you are going to see in part one roll into their parts in two. Then we got some new faces. And Austin Butler shows up. Now, Austin Butler has been kind of a hot prospect lately. Austin Butler showed up in a lot of things. He was Elvis, right? One of the things which I'm honestly, I can go into a whole another side note about Masters of the Air. I tell you, I love Band of Brothers. I love the Pacific. Great shows. And Masters of the Air is the same from the same production team. And Austin Butler is one of the main characters in that film. And it's just not great. Anyway, he's great in this one, though. He plays Fayed Rautha. There's some spoilers that will come up with the plot in terms of him, but in this one, if you remember the original Dune film, like, you know, there's the different kind of places that people are going to be, the bad guys, the good guys. Everybody's a bad guy. Let's just be honest. There's a few good guys, but everybody's a bad guy. And he plays just a great, he plays a great character in this. And he's a great bad guy. Is he really a bad guy? Yeah, he's really a bad guy. Anyway, he does a great job in this. Florence Pugh makes an appearance. I really kind of even forgot that she was in here. And she is the princess of the Emperor. And I'm telling you, everything that Florence Pugh is in now, she just gets better and better, I feel like, in everything that she does. And in this one, it's no different. She's excellent. Excellent in this. Dave Bautista shows up again from reprising his role from part one, and he's only in this for bits and pieces in part two, but he's fine. He's good. He just has such a minor part in this that some of his stuff kind of gets overshadowed a bit, and that's okay. But he was fine. I would say my biggest complaint from an acting standpoint in this was actually one of the kind of the top-notch people that you'll see that made an appearance, and that was Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken is the Emperor in this, and he makes an appearance. It's just, he could have been a better Christopher Walken, if that makes sense. It probably doesn't make sense. It just wasn't. I found his part, of all the parts, of all the people portraying things, his was the worst. His was lacking for sure. I just didn't like what we got out of him. Lee Seydoux makes an appearance as well. Stellan Skarsgård reprises his role. Charlotte Rampling reprises her role. Both are great. Stellan is Baron Harkonnen, and of course he's overbearing and creepy, and the prosthetics are great. Charlotte Rampling is, you know, in it, you know, from time to time, and also creepy as the one of the Bene Gesserit. The whole cast, like I said, for the most part, it's just solid cast, and I love the fact we got consistency, and I love the fact that the new faces that showed up were excellent as well. So out of 20, I'm going to give the cast an 18. No. Next one we're going to go with, okay, so cast is out of 20. I gave it an 18. Let's rephrase that. Director. Now this one's going to be based out of 15, and this one's, you know, pretty easy. We got a repeat performance from Denis Villeneuve. I'm overstating it. Anyway, he directed the first one, but has also directed Blade Runner, 2049. He directed Arrival. I mean, he's done so many things that the first Sicario movie, which is honestly really good. A lot of what he does is very good. He's got a writing credit as well, as most directors end up having for some big pictures like this. But I think he has an idea in mind of what he wanted to do. Obviously, if we're going to put this into three parts, four parts, however many parts it's going to be, you have to have an idea from part A to part B, how things are going to move, how timelines are going to progress, how people are going to grow within their character, how people are going to fade away within their character, what's going to change on the landscape on the planet, what's going to change in the landscape in the universe in which they live in. And he's got that whole thing kind of mapped out, played out appropriately, in a sense that there's a lot of cohesiveness. The first film was really kind of a character building arc. It told a story, it delivered us some action, it left things in peril. And what you get in this one is the same thing. A lot of storytelling, character development. You know, you're watching the main character grow into his being. Even though he doesn't believe in it, it's just an interesting progression in the timeline. And it's a big spectacle because there is a lot going on, right? This is a big story. There's a lot of bodies, faces, livelihoods. There's a lot going on. And to have that story to tell and be consistent in that storytelling is not an easy thing to do. But I think he does it, and his cinematography in these movies are always great. It's top notch in this. But with the writing, the editing, the story building, the anticipation, I wanted to see part two after part one was done. I wanted more. And I said in this one, I wanted more. It's hard to make a perfect film. There are some things in which the plot, you know, there's some weird things in the plot that don't make a lot of sense. There are some points in the movie that kind of drag. Anything that's 3 hours long, it's hard to maintain the attention span and have that level of storytelling. But for the most part, he did a really good job with that. So out of a total of 15 points, I'm going to give a score of 13. Okay, we're going to move on to the next part here, which is the locations. Now, this one's pretty easy. You're in a desert world. Now, that's not entirely true. Arrakis is a desert planet, and the majority of the story is going to revolve around that desert planet. But I'm telling you, the vastness of this is delivered expertly. It looks fantastic. How can just a thing of sand look great? Watch the movie. You'll find out. Now, when they go to the areas that are more inhabited by humans, obviously when you're on Arrakis, those things are going to look more, you know, old. They're made of stone. Things are inscribed in stone throughout these different areas that they visit. It has a more, quote, ancient feel to it. And all of those places looked excellent. They didn't look overdone. They didn't look overstated. They didn't look like they were trying too hard. Or they didn't look like it looked fake. It looked spot on. When you went to the main areas, once again, inhabited by humans, where the Harkonnens were on Arrakis. You didn't get a lot of that, but you got enough. And that stuff still looked great, because that was the mix of that older style with the more modern built into it. But then when you get to the Harkonnens' homeland, oh my gosh, like just that scummy, dreary, like mechanized, industrial look to it that looked awesome, just awesome. But when they were outside, there was almost like this little arena area they did a little battle in for show, for spectator sport, let's call it. It looked fantastic. Fantastic. Part of that can be attributed to the cinematography, of course. But there's this pale, bright, it was like whites and blacks in this just shearing, like oversized arena. And it looked great. I mean, every location that was set in this, the color, the vastness of it, the right aesthetic for the type of people inhabiting these areas, everything, the detail of it was great, just fantastic. This was an easy one. So locations, there's a score, the possibility is 10. It's a 10. And it's a 10. Easy. Okay, let's move on to the next category, props. So we have another category here that's got a possibility of 10 points. And when we look at the props in this one, you have a lot of suits that the different factions are wearing and different people within the factions are wearing. Weapons, lots of swords and knives. But there are weapons that are projectile weapons, or let's just be generic and call them laser weapons, you know, all of those types of things too. And I'm telling you, man, there's this one sequence with a Harkonnen, and it kind of gets you into it. Like the movie just starts, right? You're back into the movie. You're back into the action, if you will. It just starts up. If you don't know what's going on, well, that's on you. But the Harkonnens are trying to hunt down the groups in general, right? Because the Fremen are trouble and they're, you know, ruining the spice trade. But the suits that the Harkonnens have to be out there to go hunting, they just have this ominous, cool. It's hard. The suits looked awesome. They looked dope. It's even the detail, right? So you're out in this hot, hot, hot desert, and you have to be able to function while you're out there. And the Fremen have, you know, the suits that recycle the water, but the Harkonnens, they're not going to have that, right? That's not how that's going to work. So they have these suits that are built for, it's built for battle, let's just call it. And on the back of the helmets, they have these little fans that are running to cycle the air through and keep things, like, the detail on these suits, man, was just great. Just great. The gowns that were worn, so when we talked about the cast and we said Florence Pugh was in here and she's the princess, she had a different gown and a different headdress, like in every type of scene that she was in. And that stuff just looked phenomenal. It looked phenomenal on her. The detail that they had in them was great. Oh my gosh. It's hard for me to say, like, oh, you know, sometimes when we do our reviews, we say, oh, I see that thing that they built. You know, it looked like a cheesy little prop because of how it was constructed or because of how the scene played out. I didn't notice any of that in any of those scenes. Everything just looked great. That's hard to say because that doesn't happen very often. But in this one, man, the costuming, the props, good, great, excellent, and consistent too. I mentioned when we went back to the Harkonnens and we were on their homeland in that celebration, the outfits that they had, that they were wearing in there, the knives, there was these guards, the creepy looking with these big old head things that were in the stadium. They looked so creepy. It was excellent. Excellent. So that's an easy 10. Easy 10 out of 10 on that one. Next category, cinematography. So this is out of a possible 15. I can't overstate, all the way around state, how great things looked in this movie. Now, Ken will talk about camera angles. You can look at all the different angles in this. You can do things that are wide angle with the appropriate lighting. You can do things that were close up. There were plenty of shots that were like that. When you're trying to get the breadth of everything happening in some of these shots, and you have the camera angles that are subtle, not moving, but are wide to encompass everything with the proper lighting, excellent. Color, excellent. Lighting, excellent. So many nice things. When you are in a vast desert, how can you make the browns look good, right? Watch the movie. The desert cinematography and the lighting and the sun, how it hits everything with the little sparkle of the red through the spice in certain areas, just looked great. Oftentimes we'll throw in a lot of the CGI stuff, if you will, into, at least I will, I'll throw it a lot of times into the cinematography. Man, some of these things, the ships that they were piloting, the harvesters that they were utilizing, everything just had this scale to it with detail on it that made them look so real. And the ships, when they were coming in to attack or, you know, fire rocket barrages at whatever it was, just those intricate things looked so phenomenal, like very good. And the sound effects, oh my gosh, we don't have a sound effects part, so we'll throw that into the cinematography. The sound effects that were happening all around us in the battle sequences, in the fighting sequences, in the sequences that had representation just from buildings or creatures. It was just excellent. The wind, I mean, everything looked great. If I could give the cinematography score a 17 out of 15, I would do it. But I mean, normally we could. That's how we cheat and get our scores, right? But in this one, I'll be true to our scoring technique, and I will give it a 15 out of 15. Okay, the one that we do have is score. It's not sound effects, it's score. This one's hard. You know, you're not building a score with traditional songs. You're building a score to revolve around the moment. You're building a score to fill the void in times where there should be sound. And of course, they build it appropriately where there are times where there should not be sound. You're building the score to build anticipation. You're building the score to build horror. You're building the score to build anticipation for what is going to happen, what you're seeing, what's going to happen. And the score in this does not let down. It does not distract. It builds the appropriate amount of tension when it needs to. It's hard to describe the score in a certain sense, because the best scores, in some instances, you don't notice because they blend in with the movie so well that they make the movie a complete piece. And that was this one. So the score has a possible 10. I gave this one a 9. very good. There's nothing that stood out to me in terms of like something that was obtrusive that got in the way of what was happening. Everything built everything else around it very well. Okay, so the last one, which is a lot of times in our scores, the deal breaker is the plot. It's a big one too. It's out of 20 points. And the plot, I will go back to it. I don't know if this or how well this holds to the original source material. I'm guessing it's not spot on. No movie ever is. I think this does more justice to the original reading material compared to the movie from 40 years ago. I don't know. Remember, I didn't read it, so I don't know. But what you see in the first movie from 40 years ago is a different type of story. This story, it's flat out telling you, and you get some of that information from one, but it's in this one too. Like, this is a revenge story. You killed my family. I'm going to get you. That's what this movie is. And maybe it's disguised in some form or fashion, but really it's, I'm going to kill the emperor. Like that's what it is. I'm going to take revenge for my family. And you see kind of the innocence in the Paul Atreides character disappear. And you see a ruthlessness. And you see an excellent fighter, right? Like, he was already had that training. That was something that was already kind of, he grew up with that. He was a smart kid. He grew up with that. And his mother trained him for the voice. Like, he had a lot of training already growing up in his life. But when your whole entire family and your whole entire culture is annihilated, and now it's just you, as far as you know, it's just you. It is, you have to grow up quick. And I'm telling you, he grew up quick in this. And like I said, became ruthless. It's, there's a sequence at the end where there's always the big fight sequence where they're fighting with all the Fremen and the worms to take back the planet. And in the 80s, he took back the planet. Yes, I got it. This one, they played some games to get the emperor to come to the planet, which was like, that was way too easy. And then the emperor is there. They took back the city. They captured the emperor and the princess. And it was like, everything was way too easy at the end. But anyway, the whole a subplot through this movie is his love for the Zendaya character, right? They built a relationship together, and then slowly towards the end, that relationship fell apart because the Shani character is looking out for her people. But Paul, remember, it's a revenge story. Paul's looking for revenge. And those two ideals don't play hand in hand, but it's, there's that underscoring of that love story throughout that. And with that love story, there's the falling apart. And at the end, like, he's so cold and ruthless. He stares her in the eyes, like, at one part, and says, like, I will always love you. And then goes right to a different part about going to marry the princess. It's almost this cold reversal of, I will always love you, and I'm going to go marry this girl right now, and we're going to unify things. Sorry. And it's just like, it is a turn. You know, part of it in this too is the Harkonnens are the, quote, bad guys, right? They are the ones who are do bad things, and they're underhanded and they're ruthless and blah, blah, blah. And we find out that the Paul Atreides character is actually Harkonnen, because the Jessica, the mother character, She is Harkonnen. She's Baron Harkonnen's daughter. And what you get out of that is a plot point that was never there in the first movie, right? So if you're a child of that movie and you never read the material, that could be a little bit of a shock to the system. Like, oh my gosh, there's more storylines in here. But if you grew up on the Game of Thrones side, you know, of things, and you're like, oh, okay, so like there's all these subplots for these things. And it has more interest and more layers and levels to what's going on. And remember, like I said, the story is a revenge story. And the things turn so quickly in the end where it's just like, I'm really taking this revenge thing and we're going to, all those other, the families and the planets, all right, let's go get them now. We're going to kill everybody. And just like, Like what is going on here? And the whole other movie is going to be like, you know, the maybe three is going to be like Overlord Paul Atreides. And it's such a great twist. Like you see it building through this. He's a smart person. He's a caring person. And that stuff just kind of starts to, it takes a back seat and he becomes ruthless in this. And that's the, I think, the twist that people weren't prepared for, because that's not, he embraces his Harkonnen. He even says it briefly in the movie, I'm Harkonnen, you know, like, might as well act like one. And he just becomes ruthless. But the whole thing about this, too, is the Bene Gesserit have been in place putting the story in people's ears for hundreds of years in all of these different places. And he is the one that has brought this story to fruition. So it's kind of got this other subplot in it about, you know, this religion, if you will, twisting the minds of people and having them in place on all of the planets. They've been on Arrakis forever, telling the Fremen of things to come, right? And so now you have the Fremen that have the plot of, like, they are in the religious sect, the ones from the south that are heavily relying on that, where the people from the north don't so much. And so you got to bring those two together to have this massive collection of people and army to be able to fight anybody. It's just, there's all these different subplots, and I'm so glad that I watched part one again, because the storytelling in part one was great. It told you exactly what you needed to know about spice, about the trade, about how the religion was getting pressed in different areas, about the emperor, so much stuff that having reviewed the first movie, it made the second one so much better. It made the story much easier to follow. It made the different plot points and story points make sense. Now, like I said, there's always weak spots in terms of how things are delivered to you. And we like to pick apart things, and normally the plot just gets hammered in a lot of these, and we pick at things. And I didn't find a lot to overly pick at, right? You know, one of the things about the battle sequences, for example, the weapons being used in here, you can see them throughout, where there's these big lasers and they just shoot and they annihilate everybody. Like not everybody, because all the hand-to-hand combat is with swords and knives. Remember, they have the shields, and the shields, if there's something that's moving rapidly, the shields won't go through them. What about lasers? They shoot these lasers at these harvesters, and it just obliterates them. Is that what happens when you shoot the lasers at the shields too? I don't get it. That part was, maybe I missed that part of the discussion in the first movie or this one, but you have these lasers that just annihilate things. Why wouldn't you go like, here's my laser, and just wipe out everybody? I don't know. I'm probably missing a point, but that was one tiny little nitpicky thing. you know, I know that the fighters are expertly trained, but it looks like when you're in Dune 1, it was about moving at the proper pace to go through these shields so that you could get your knife, your weapon through them. But in this one, it's like there's total disregard for that at all. They're just swatting, slicing, and maybe they're just expert fighters. Who knows? But it's like those shields have very little impact against the hand-to-hand weapons that everybody was equipped with. But hey, maybe everybody's just such an expert fighter that those shields become irrelevant. Who knows? You know, in one of the big sequences that you'll see is the worm riding, right? So that really shows that you have become a Fremen, and it's a big deal. It's, you have to be able to call them, you have to be able to get your hooks in them, survive through this stuff, like this whole ordeal to get on top of it in order to control the worms as you're piloting them. Yet it seems like it's easy as hell to load them with thousands of people and transport them from the northern region to the southern region through the gigantic storm that's there. I just didn't get the concept of, man, that must be easy to get on the back of a worm with just hundreds of people per worm. And one of the things, they transport equipment, they transport people in little pods and tents, and just like, how did you get everybody on those worms when it was such an ordeal for one person to get on there to control that worm? I'm nitpicking, right? But it's interesting. I like the concept of using the worms as travel in addition to just, you know, a battle implement, if you will. But the implementation of the travel was never delved into and largely overlooked in its logistics, let's call it. In terms of the plot, if you are not paying attention and you're missing out, there's so many names for people, and there's so many names for Paul Atreides, there's so many titles that he's got. It's sometimes hard to keep up with the different words and the titles and the names of things, just because they all like get intermingled in terms of their reference. That's not a necessarily a plot thing. It's hard to pay attention and understand all the different intricacies of the titling and the positions that these people have, especially the Paul Atreides character. That's a minor complaint. The whole storyline is hard. If you are a casual movie goer and you're not used to doing the sci-fi thing, it's hard to follow along those plot lines. Like if you are a Game of Thrones person, you had 8, 10, 13 episodes to follow along, and that stuff was impossible to follow along with sometimes. So I could understand how in this 3-hour movie, you're trying to like remember, like, wait, who is this person? Where did this person come from? Why is this person important? Like, what's going on with this faction? I totally get that. That's where I say, go watch part one again to get a good base reference on all the different characters and the positions and the people and the factions. But overall, the plot really didn't have, it definitely had weak spots. Like I said, the ending, the middle, there were lulls, and the ending just kind of came all together all at once. And so the pacing was off a bit, but not anything that just made me like question what was going on. There were just weird lapses. You know, some of the things that, if you go through this, from the time that everybody was wiped out and Paul and his mom got lost, got pushed to the desert, to him getting trained, to him being part of the group, to him leading the group, to him controlling the group, it seemed like that should have taken a long time, like a long time, but it didn't. And his the Jessica, the mother character, was pregnant, right? Now, if the gestation period, let's call it, for this is the same as it is in most humans, and it's 9 months, then this whole movie took place over the course of 9 months. And because the baby was never born. In the first movie in the 80s, the Paul's sister was born. Of course, she was creepy, but she was like she was the second coming, right? Like she was instantly a high ranking, or not high ranking. She was like a Bene Gesserit, like high end priestess, right? Who really loved Paul, like was there to protect Paul. And they speak in this movie. They communicate from the womb, but she's never born. It seems to me like this whole movie timeline would have been a couple of years, right? Just to gain acceptance, do not necessarily training, but training, right? Becoming better at becoming a Fremen. And the baby's never born. And I'm just like, what is the time frame in this? So I lost a little on that, because maybe I missed a detail in there, but the time frame seemed weird. Anyway, out of 20, I gave the plot 17. There are so many things that could be overcomplicated. This is the top level of complication, but not overly complicated. You just got to pay attention. It's hard to do when there's so many other explosions and cool things going on. But if we go with the total, this gets a whopping 92 out of 100. This is a top-notch film. I would like to watch more. I will be eagerly anticipating the opportunity to watch this again when it comes out in streaming. And I highly recommend watching this. If you liked the first one, if you're a fan of sci-fi, if you liked the one, if you're old like me and you liked the one from 40 years ago, this is just like a retelling with fancier pictures and better acting, and a different kind of story plot line. It's great. It's worth watching. Pay your bucks to go watch it in the theater. I tell you what, I sat in like the front rows and I just rested my head on the back of that chair and I let the whole thing just explode me in the face. It was great. It was fantastic. And even when I did that, I still had people that sat right next to me, which was crazy. Anyway, I'm nitpicking on that. It's worth watching. Go check it out. Check out our website for my previous reviews on the two Dune movies that I've talked about here and there. And, you know, check us out on Twitter at Real Pudding Guys. Every once in a while, we'll throw something cool up on Instagram. That's the Pudding Guys. But the website's got some of the good information, and it's got the upcoming list of our next few episodes. What's coming up next week? So many things to do, so many people to talk to. I guess you'll have to find out.